terrorism was a way of life here, sometimes even a daily occurrence. With that in mind, it would serve to reason that the assassin wasn't the only armed person on the beach. Maybe Jack could recruit a good guy or two. But a quick sweep of the boardwalk put that notion to rest. No overt security presence at all. This didn't mean that a plainclothes security official wasn't concealed carrying, but hidden weapons did Jack no good. By the time he figured out who was armed, Tommy would be motherless. No, stopping the slaughter remained Jack's responsibility. But how? Jack was running out of time. The Asian man was now less than 20 meters away. Jack needed to act. Conducting a final sweep of the beach, he found salvation. It felt like karma. To his right, a collection of brightly colored surfboards was clustered next to a wooden shack like psychedelic lawn ornaments. While even the short boards were much too long for what Jack had in mind, a dark-toned skimboard poked from the bottom of the pile. Grabbing the length of laminated wood, Jack sprinted toward the Asian man. A shout let Jack know that his act of larceny hadn't gone unnoticed, but he figured he could deal with the upset proprietor later. Assuming there was a later. Jack was now to the left and slightly behind the Asian man, who was continuing his stalk toward the hapless pair. Jack pumped his knees, leaning into the sprint, flashing back to his days as a high school linebacker. He pictured the assassin as an unwitting wide receiver he was about to level. And then he was face first in the sand. Untangling himself from the pair of muscular arms that had brought him down, Jack found himself face to face with his bare-chested assaulter. Apparently, the surfboard rental shop's proprietor believed in actively deterring theft. The kid looked about 20, with bronze skin and a shock of brown hair that fell across his eyes. And he was angry. Very angry. While Jack could sympathize, he didn't have time to explain. Slipping under a wild cross, Jack struck the kid in the throat, using the webbing between his thumb and index finger to soften the blow. Jack didn't put much behind the strike, aiming for shock and awe rather than injury. If the kid's startled expression was any indication, Jack seemed to have achieved his goal. The torrent of angry Hebrew ceased as the kid grabbed his throat, coughing. "Sorry," Jack said, rolling to his feet, "but I need this. I'll be back." Jack picked up the sandy skimboard and turned back toward his target. His stomach clenched. The Asian man was now less than 10 feet from the woman. An easy shot. The man's presence seemed to have pinged something on Tommy's radar. The boy turned from where he'd been watching the surf swirl around his feet to the looming assassin, his eyes going wide at the man's appearance. For his part, the killer ignored the child completely, extending his left arm toward the kneeling mother's head. It was going down, right here, right now, and Jack was too far away to stop it. Putting the fingers of one hand to his lips, Jack gave a piercing horse whistle shrill enough to raise the dead. And then, just to make sure the Asian man got the message, Jack screamed, "Hey!" at the top of his lungs. Ding was famous for saying that he'd rather be lucky than good, and while the sentiment had never really made sense to Jack before, it did now. Along with just about everyone else on the beach, the Asian man turned his head reflexively toward Jack, which meant that he caught the skimboard Jack hurled like a javelin right between his eyes. Part of Jack actually wanted to pause to marvel at the sheer perfection of the throw. He could have tossed the board 1,000 times and probably never achieved the same result. The length of wood had flown in a perfectly arcing trajectory, just like Nolan Ryan's famous fastball. Even from 20 feet away, Jack heard the assassin's nose shatter with a satisfying crunch. If there was ever a time to appreciate a perfect trick shot, it was now. Unfortunately, Jack couldn't afford to rest on his laurels. Instead, he was doing his best to follow the board's flight path. His 6'2" frame barreled into the dazed assassin like a runaway freight train. Jack had a split second to ponder another bit of wisdom, this time from his dad rather than Ding. If you're going to be stupid, you'd better be tough, before he slammed into the assassin, leading with his elbows. Jack felt the jarring shock all the way down the length of his forearms as his stitches tore loose. Even his fingers tingled. A physics major, Jack was not, But the amount of force generated by the bone-on-bone impact should have put the Asian man down for keeps. But it didn't. Even with blood streaming down his face and blinded by his own tears, the man had somehow still sensed Jack's devastating attack. At the last second, he'd bladed his body, turning the impact into a glancing blow. Instead of splitting the man's sternum, Jack had sent the assassin spinning toward the surf. Recovering his balance, Jack pivoted toward his opponent, intending to stomp the man's solar plexus into mush. The assassin had other ideas. A hand cleared the water. A hand holding a gun. Jack threw himself right as the pistol spit, the round snapping by his face. He landed next to the skimboard, and Jack grabbed the length of wood, jabbing it at the assassin's ruined nose. The man batted the thrust away, and his pistol coughed again. A bullet tore through the board, peppering Jack's cheek with splinters. Jack needed to take the pistol out of play. Now. Flopping down on top of the lacquered wood, Jack sandwiched the Asian man between the skimboard and the snarling surf. As bullets erupted in showers of wood chips, Jack spun atop the board's slick surface, turning his body perpendicular to the assassin's. He hammered a knee into the man's side while gripping the wrist holding the gun with both hands, slamming it against the sand. The assassin squirmed beneath him, but Jack's weight prevented him from bringing his non-firing arm to bear. For the first time, Jack was getting the better of the assassin. While the soft sand kept Jack from bashing the man's wrist hard enough to free the pistol, the ocean was working in Jack's favor. The rolling breakers frothed over Jack's torso, spraying his eyes with stinging salt, but the foaming surf did far worse to the assassin. Each time a roller crashed ashore, the water completely submerged the Asian man's face. It was hard to concentrate on fighting when you couldn't breathe. Shifting his weight again, Jack worked the assassin's forearm into a figure-four armbar. Once the pistol was immobilized, Jack wrenched his shoulders upward while pinning the assassin to the sand with a modified side-control grappling position. Not exactly the type of form that would impress judges at a jiu-jitsu competition, but Jack was still alive and controlling the fight. That would have to do. But the gunman knew a thing or two about grappling. Twice he bridged his hips, trying to sweep Jack out of position while he curled his arm toward his own chest, negating the armbar's leverage. Though he was at least 20 pounds lighter than Jack, the Asian man had a gymnast's core. He bucked like a bronco, and if they were on mats or even hard ground, his escape might have worked. But not today. The wet sand absorbed the energy the assassin was trying to generate, and Jack doubled down, slamming his chest against the slick skimboard. Finally, Jack's greater bulk and strength were starting to pay dividends. The skimboard distributed Jack's weight across the man's entire torso, flattening the assassin's shoulders to the ground as the board's edge knifed into the man's sternum. The pistol fired again, the muted muzzle blast close enough to set Jack's ears ringing. But even the cocktail of hot gases scorching his face didn't distract Jack. Like a pit bull, he kept worrying the gunman's arm, tightening his hold, and locking down the man's elbow and forearm. The Asian man was incredibly strong, and Jack grunted with the effort of peeling the assassin's arm away from his chest. Shifting position on the skimboard, Jack rocketed a knee toward the gunman's head. The assassin got his non-shooting arm in the way, deflecting some of the blow. But Jack's thick kneecap still connected with the gunman's temple, rocking his head. For a split second, the tension in the gunman's arm slackened. Jack pounced. Twisting his shoulders, Jack engaged his traps, lats, and core as he wrenched the gunman's arm skyward, grunting with the effort. There was a pop that he felt as much as heard as the assassin's wrist gave way. "You're mine now, motherfucker," Jack said as the pistol plopped into the surf beside him. And that would have been true, if not for the chainsaw-like sound coming from behind him. Turning his head, Jack froze, trying to make sense of what he was seeing. At first, he saw only black. Then Jack realized that the blackness was actually a boat. The correct term was rigid inflatable boat, also known by its more common nomenclature of Zodiac. But Jack didn't have time to ponder the nuance of the watercraft's naming convention, because it was skipping across the waves straight at him. Then the Zodiac's hard rubber hull crashed into his chest. Sky chased sea as Jack cartwheeled through the air before landing heavily on his back. Coughing, Jack rolled over onto shaky knees, just in time to be hit full in the face with a second deluge of salt water to the high-pitched scream of a revving motor. Wiping the burning liquid from his eyes, Jack watched as the Zodiac tore back out to sea, bouncing from swell to swell. He had no idea what had just happened, but the stretch of water where the assassin had been lying seconds before was now empty. On the plus side, for the moment, no one was trying to kill him. It wasn't much of a win, but Jack would take it. "Who are you?" Jack turned toward the speaker to see Tommy's mom standing behind him, her arms wrapped around the little boy. "I was just about to ask you the same question," Jack said. Chapter 21. Darian had never been more thankful to feel the pulsing of his cell phone. "So sorry," Darian said with an apologetic smile. "Got to take this." "We," his companion said, waving Darian away. "Perhaps we can talk again later." "Looking forward to it," Darian said as he fished the phone from his pocket. "Ciao." The detestable Frenchman had cornered Darian as he'd waited in line for a cocktail, attaching himself like a leech for the next 30 minutes. In his cover as a venture capitalist, Darian was used to listening to the prattle of self-important scientists convinced that they'd made the next life-altering discovery. In fact, Darian welcomed a little arrogance. After all, he was a spy, and spies made their livelihood exploiting the bravado of others. Even so, the French researcher was in a class all his own. After being lectured for the third time about how disappointed his investors would be if Darian allowed another fund to beat him to the Frenchman's door, Darian was ready to snap the man's neck, consequences be damned. Fortunately, his phone provided a much-needed interruption. "Hello," Darian said, smiling as he worked his way from the ballroom in search of a quieter space to talk. Though Tel Aviv was quite a haul for the American scientists in attendance, the Israeli organizers had spared no expense to make their trip worthwhile. The Hilton Tel Aviv certainly knew how to throw a good party. "We have a problem." The words sent a shiver down Darian's spine for more reasons than one. The sound of the speaker's voice conjured up images of the weekend they'd spent in Vienna, a weekend in which they'd seen very little besides the confines of their hotel room and each other. But this delightful feeling was competing with the meaning behind the voice's words. "Explain," Darian said. Though the caller, like Darian, was fluent in a number of languages, the conversation was conducted in English. This was not done for convenience's sake. The eyes of the Army of Signal Intercept officers laboring in the IDF's infamous Unit 8200 were ever watchful. Akin to the U.S. National Security Agency, Unit 8200 specialized in vacuuming up SIGINT, or Signals Intelligence. And though the organization's capabilities were formidable, the men and women working were only human. This meant that they were cursed with a human's finite ability to process the plethora of information prioritized for their consumption by the horde of adaptive algorithms at work on their behalf. With this in mind, capturing English communications was a lower priority than electronic tidbits featuring conversations in threat languages. Darian knew he couldn't completely hide from the Israelis' omnipotent-seeming collection capabilities. But perhaps he could seek shelter in a pile of secondary data while the analysts pursued other leads that seemed more promising. Much like a chameleon, Darian didn't aspire to invisibility. He just wanted to look less enticing than other potential prey. "We are not the only interested party." Darian processed the speaker's words as another false smile slid onto his face, The pair of scientists from India were trying to catch his eye, and while the two women didn't have the pugnaciousness of the Frenchman, they were no less determined. Pointing to his phone, Darian turned away from the researchers. "Another recruitment," Darian said, finally finding a quiet corner between the bathrooms and the foyer leading to the lobby. This had been his biggest fear. Though he'd successfully wooed his target to Israel, he knew that a fish this big would certainly tempt other fishermen. "No. The new party seems intent on taking our player out of the game altogether." Darian swallowed to cover the sudden dryness in his mouth. This was unexpected. As much as he would have preferred that the academic conference take place in Vienna or one of the other European Union countries whose lax border control was much more hospitable to spies, working in Israel had its benefits, chief of those being that you had to be absolutely mad to try something kinetic on Israeli soil. Or the kind of angry that came only from being double-crossed. "Our friend survived the encounter?" "Yes, but she's no longer coming to the party." Darian considered the caller's words, thinking about their ramifications. Like a good case officer, he had prepared for contingencies. Even so, there was a difference between preparing and executing. As he thought, his gaze traveled across the hotel, settling on the Frenchman, who was even now corralling another VC representative into a one-way conversation. That the scientist was a pompous ass who undoubtedly was overhyping his breakthrough was a given. But even so, Darian thought that the man would leave the conference with at least two new sources of funding for his fledgling laboratory. As Darian had learned time and time again, success didn't come to the bright or polite. It was bestowed on the ruthless few, willing to do what others weren't. Like Darian. "Provide our guest with a personal invitation," Darian said, watching as the Frenchman secured a coveted business card from the surrendering investor. "Her attendance is mandatory." Chapter 22. "How's that ice cream, buddy?" As before, the little boy didn't respond to Jack's question verbally, but he gave a pudgy thumbs up with his left hand while pushing the melting clump of chocolate gelato around the plastic bowl with his right. "You're pretty good with him." Jack shrugged as he shifted his attention from boy to mother. "I had a friend like him growing up." "Like him how?" the woman said, her tone taking a frostier turn. "Hey, I didn't mean anything," Jack said, holding up his hands in surrender. "I just noticed how attached he was to old Cap there, and it reminded me of a kid I went to school with. Except for him, it was a penny. I could never see anything special about it. But to him, it was everything," the woman said, her voice warmer. "I'm sorry. It's been a crazy day." "No need to apologize. I'm just glad I could get Captain America back to you safe and sound." At the mention of the superhero, the boy curled his fingers around the toy, as if to reassure himself that the figure really was back safe and sound. Currently, Cap was guarding the boy's ice cream bowl. Tommy hadn't let the toy out of arm's reach since Jack had reunited the pair. "Who are you?" the woman said, unscrewing the cap on her water bottle. Normalcy had returned to the beach almost before the Zodiac bearing the assassin had disappeared from view. Though several of the beachgoers had seen the scuffle, no one had been close enough to hear the suppressed pistol. The boat's appearance had certainly caused a stir, but no bombs had exploded, and no armed terrorists had sprayed machine gun fire into the crowd. By Israeli standards, the whole incident wasn't worth getting excited about. Someone had made noise about calling the police, but the woman had turned away all offers for help. Except Jax. He had asked if she and her son would join him at one of the many outdoor cafes that bordered the beach, and she'd agreed. Jack had a feeling this was partly because of his American accent, And partly because when the man who's saved your life twice in the same day asks you to ice cream, you don't say no. Now they were sitting at a covered table watching the surf wash over the same patch of sand that 30 minutes ago had been the site of a life and death struggle. The sun was setting, transforming the Mediterranean Sea into an ocean of burnished copper as the cafes, restaurants, and bars lining the beach glowed with soft light. Surreal didn't even begin to cover how Jack was feeling. "My name is Jack. Jack Ryan." "That sounds like a superhero's name," the woman said. Jack smiled. "I've got Irish blood, so it's basically the same thing." The woman smiled in return, and once again Jack was struck by how much the simple gesture transformed her face. When they were fixed on you, her green eyes were captivating, but the rest of her features, while pleasant, were nothing memorable. Until she smiled. "I'm Becca Schweigart, and this is my son Tommy. Say hi to Jack, Tommy." Once again, the boy gave no indication that he'd heard, but Captain America dipped his head in Tommy's chubby fingers. "Great to meet you, Tommy," Jack said with a smile. Then he turned back to Becca, a more serious expression on his face. "You're a pretty popular girl. Any idea why someone might try to kill you twice in one day?" Becca's smile became a frown. "Why do you care?" "I don't believe in just watching things happen," Jack said, holding up his bandaged forearms. "Look, you don't owe me anything. Say the word and I'll leave. But it seems to me that the men who are after you are both determined and well-financed. That's not a good combination." "Are you FBI?" Becca said. "Nope," Jack said. "Just a good Samaritan. But I have some friends who might be able to help. Why don't you tell me who you are and why you're here? Then we'll figure the rest out together." Becca looked at Jack in silence for a moment, her green eyes boring into his. Then she slowly nodded. "I don't know why, but I feel like I can trust you," Becca said, settling back in her chair. "The truth is, I have no idea why someone is trying to kill me. I really don't." "But you've talked with the FBI?" Jack said, pulling on the earlier thread. "Yes, look, it's my favorite American cowboy." Jack turned to see Tal, Dudu, and a collection of rough-looking men. They didn't look happy. Chapter 23. Ocean air spilled into the car, blanketing Jack in the scent of salt water. Relaxing in his seat, Jack closed his eyes and breathed deeply, trying to understand how things had gone so off track. He'd been genuinely happy to see Tal up and about, but something between them had clearly changed. Though she'd led with her trademark flirty banter, it didn't last long. Or more specifically, Tal as the speaker didn't last long. Before Jack could respond, Dudu had inserted himself between the two. In no uncertain terms, he'd told Jack that his time in Israel was at a close. He was going to the airport, willingly or with help. One look at Dudu's henchmen had convinced Jack the Shin Bet officer wasn't bluffing. The men were built like fire hydrants. Jack hadn't had the pleasure of operating with anyone from Israel before, but if he had to guess, the newcomers were on loan from Israel's fabled Sayeret Matkal, an elite commando unit only slightly less prestigious than the U.S. Army's Delta Force. Though the men weren't visibly carrying weapons, Jack knew scrappers when he saw them. Besides, the men wore untucked shirts, which meant that Jericho pistols were within easy reach. Becca didn't have Jack's tactical experience, but she seemed to recognize predators when she saw them. Turning from the Israeli paramilitary team to Jack, she'd asked just one question. "What happens now?" "Whatever they say," Jack had replied. And what they'd said was to stand up slowly and head for the two cars parked on Hayar Khan Street. Jack had tried to grab a word with Tal, but Dudu wasn't about to let that happen. He'd separated Jack from Becca and Tommy, Tal walked with the mother and son while the remainder of the team herded Jack in the same direction. When they got to the street, Tal and two of the commandos bundled Becca into the lead vehicle while Jack, Dudu, and the remaining commandos piled into the second. Tal paused for a moment as she was getting in, catching Jack's eye over the car's roof. But she gave him nothing more than a sad smile before ducking inside. That had been 5 minutes ago, and until now the ride had passed in silence. Perhaps it was time for that to change. "Why are you doing this?" Jack said. "You have only yourself to blame," Dudu said. "We offered you the chance to do the right thing. You refused."
"Your idea of the right thing is curious," Jack said, leaning forward. "I saved the American's life twice, which was more than I can say for the vaunted Shin Bet or Sayaret."
The driver partially turned in his seat before Dudu arrested his motion with a burst of Hebrew. The man seemed on the verge of arguing, but didn't. Even so, the look he'd given Jack spoke volumes. Jack had hit a nerve.
"All right," Dudu said. "You want to speak plainly? Let's. You are a CIA operative who is working in my country undeclared. Yes, you've saved that woman's life, but I hardly think it's a coincidence that you just happened to be nearby each time a killer targeted her. Either you and your team are using her as bait, or you're simply incompetent. Both options are appalling."
Jack didn't bother to reply. Dudu was convinced he was a CIA officer, and while that wasn't true, it was close enough. In fact, the best thing Jack could do for both the campus and the real CIA team he was augmenting was to allow Dudu to continue with his mistaken assumption. The asset validation exercise was long over. Hopefully by now the CIA operatives were in the wind. As much as he hated to admit it, Dudu and his team were infinitely better equipped to protect Becca and Tommy than Jack was. Not only was this their backyard, but they dealt with terrorist attacks every day. No. The best thing Jack could do was keep his mouth shut and get on an airplane heading west. And yet...
"Do you at least know why she's being targeted?" Jack said.
"That's none of your concern," Dudu said, turning so that he was eye to eye with Jack. "Someone has tried to kill this woman twice on my watch, in my country. It is now a matter for blue and white. You know what this means."
"I do," Jack said, as the car convoy turned left, trading the ocean for views of apartment buildings and restaurants. "Though from where I'm sitting, it's been a matter for blue and white this entire time. So far, you guys have come up with Jack's shit." The lead car's brake lights glowed through the windshield as both vehicles slowed. Israel's traffic density was among the highest of any country's, and driving in Tel Aviv was a special kind of nightmare all its own. Still, commuters continued to flow past in the lanes heading the opposite direction, so maybe this would be a short delay.
"You Americans," Dudu said, shaking his head, "forever convinced that—"
Jack tuned the Shin Bet officer out, his words relegated to the buzzing of an unpleasant insect. This wasn't because Jack didn't want to hear what Dudu had to say. Jack would be the first to admit that Americans tended to approach world problems with a healthy dose of optimism that often looked a lot like arrogance. But a more in-depth self-analysis would have to wait until later. The traffic on the opposite side of the boulevard had also stopped. And that didn't feel right. No sooner had the thought entered Jack's mind than squealing brakes and crunching steel gave him something else to ponder. The collision threw Jack against the seat back in front of him, torquing his neck and back. While fender benders in Israel were almost a daily occurrence given the country's congested roadways, this felt a tad more aggressive. Turning to look behind him, Jack saw three men exiting a van. Men with masks and guns.
Chapter 24. "Contact rear," Jack shouted, as the men flowed apart, taking up shooting positions at a 45-degree angle to the car's occupants, two on Jack's side and one opposite the driver.
While one part of Jack's mind tried to figure a way out of what was rapidly becoming a no-win situation, the other marveled at the tactical fluidity on display. The men's overwatch positions were perfectly chosen to provide maximum coverage of the car, while at the same time deconflicting fires. Whoever these guys were, they'd done this a time or two. Dudu said something in Hebrew that Jack was pretty sure was inappropriate for mixed company, but in the time it took the Shin Bet officer to reach for the gun holstered at his waist, two of the shooters had pulled even with the front half of the car. Once again, Jack found himself staring down a gun barrel. "Hands on the dashboard," the shooter nearest Dudu shouted. "Now!" The command was given in accented English, but at the moment Jack couldn't focus on the speaker's nationality. He was too busy watching to see if either Israeli went for their sidearm. For the moment, prudence seemed to win. Both men stretched out their arms, splaying their fingers across the car's dashboard. The shooter covering Jack gestured upward with his rifle's muzzle, and Jack obliged, placing his palms flat against the car's roof. This was interesting. The ambushers had them dead to rights. In fact, the entire scenario would have been over by now if the shooters had come out of the van firing. But they hadn't. They wanted someone alive. Jack had a feeling he knew who. A flurry of motion at the lead car confirmed Jack's suspicions. A pair of shooters flanked the driver and passenger, rifles oriented forward so that stray bullets wouldn't accidentally catch the shooters guarding Jack's car. But this is where the similarities ended. The face mask-clad gunman oriented on the lead car, numbered 4. Now Jack understood why. A gunman standing by the rear passenger side door wrenched it open, reached inside, and pulled Becca out by her hair. His partner grabbed Tommy. "Son of a bitch," Jack said, pounding his fist against the roof. The face-masked gunmen were kidnapping the two, and all Jack could do was watch. "Fuck!" Jack said, punching the roof again. The action caught the attention of the gunman opposite Jack's window. The man glided closer on silent feet, halving the distance between them as an audible metallic click announced that he'd moved his weapon's selector switch from safe to fire. "Fuck! Fuck! Fuck!" Jack screamed, punctuating each word with a strike to the roof. The gunman moved even closer, poking his weapon's barrel through the open window until the muzzle was just inches from Jack's temple. A human brain is not nearly as evolved as people think. Logically, the gunman knew that Jack was well within the effective range of his rifle even when he'd still been 10 feet farther away. But instinct told the shooter to dominate the situation, to nip Jack's untoward behavior in the bud by reminding his hostage who was in control. So, he'd moved closer. Time slowed as Jack weighed the opportunity he'd been given, weighing the risk versus reward. If a fellow campus operative had been in the front seat, it would have been a no-brainer. But this time, he wasn't betting his life on an unknown. Jack turned his head a fraction of an inch, making eye contact with Dudu. The Shin Bet officer stared back at him, his features relaxed, his expression blank. And then he winked. Slapping the shooter's rifle up and away, Jack pinned the barrel against the roof. The weapon discharged, the 3-round burst splintering the metal roof. The muzzle blast was deafening in the car's close confines, and the shockwave pummeled Jack's face and neck. Ignoring the gonging in his ears, Jack wrapped both hands around the barrel's plastic grip and jerked across his body, trying to tear the weapon from the gunman's grasp. In a perfect world, this would have been enough to dislodge the weapon. Jack did not live in a perfect world. Instead, the rifle discharged again, and this time the burst shattered the windshield, inches from the back of the driver's head. This was still not progressing how Jack had intended. Additional gunshots echoed from the car. Dudu was no longer in the passenger seat beside him. Instead, he was firing his pistol over the crouched driver's shoulder, presumably at the second gunman. Jack didn't know if the Shin Bet officer's rounds were hitting their mark or not. He was still in a fight for his life, and anything beyond the black rifle barrel squirming against the roof was pure distraction. Jack shifted his grip on the rifle, trying to gain leverage, but it wasn't working. The element of surprise was gone, and the attacker had physics on his side. He was standing, while Jack was seated. This meant that he could put his full body weight behind his attempt to wrench the rifle free, while Jack could not. Time to change strategies. Bunching his shoulders, Jack yanked the rifle to his left while torquing the weapon, hoping to twist the gun from his assailant's fingers. The gunman responded by rocking back on his heels, dragging the weapon down and away. Jack felt the gritty plastic sliding through his fingers and knew that this time he couldn't maintain his hold. So he didn't try. Instead, he put his shoulder into the door and slammed it open, driving with his legs. The steel battering ram smashed into the crouching gunman's face and knees, knocking him off balance and taking the rifle out of play. Leaping from the car, Jack crashed into the reeling shooter, pinning the rifle lengthwise between their bodies. As the gunman struggled to free the weapon, Jack smashed him twice in the nose, rotating his shoulders into the punches. The first blow glanced off the gunman's chin, and Jack felt his hand go numb as the jarring bone-on-bone contact ran the length of his arm. But his follow-up cross landed right on the bridge of the shooter's nose. The familiar feeling of cartilage breaking beneath his knuckles was followed by a deluge of red as blood soaked through the gunman's face mask. Bingo. Jack made a grab for the rifle, but the shooter's sling hampered his efforts. Switching tactics, Jack stripped the dazed man's pistol from his drop holster, pressed the muzzle against the gunman's chest, and squeezed the trigger three times. The shooter crumpled to the pavement. One threat down. Three to go. Except that as Jack came to his feet with the pistol at the high-ready position, he saw that the Shin Bet officer and his commando driver hadn't exactly been idle. The shooter on Dudu's side of the window was down, but the gunman that had been covering the Sayeret Matkal commando was bleeding from a shoulder wound and still on his feet. The shooter was staggering toward the second van at the opposite side of the street as two of his comrades were providing covering fire. Jack took shelter behind the car's rear wheel well as a fusillade of bullets smashed into the vehicle. To his right, Jack heard answering pops as the Shin Bet officer and commando responded with their pistols. The Israelis' return fire was slower and much more disciplined. Traffic was still bumper to bumper on the other side of the street, and the risk of collateral damage was enormous. Not to mention that an automatic assault rifle beats a semi-automatic pistol any day. Especially at these distances. To their credit, the Israelis weren't hunkered down riding out the storm, but neither were they racing into the street that separated their car from the getaway van. Jack didn't blame them. Leaving cover now would be suicide, but doing nothing meant that the bad guys would vanish with Becca. Unacceptable. Leaning past the rear bumper, Jack ignored the buzzing sound of high-velocity rounds snapping by his head as he braced his right shoulder and arm against the vehicle's frame, steadying his aim. Jack had perfected his pistol skills with Chris Albanese, a former Secret Service marksmanship instructor. Now it was time to put those lessons to work. Finding his front sight post, Jack bladed the stubby notch on the gunman's legs. Hitting someone on the run took some doing. Hitting someone on the run at 40 meters was a bitch. Hitting someone on the run at 40 meters in the legs was damn near impossible. But Jack had to try. He brought his rear sights into alignment with the front sight post, then began his trigger press. He ignored the fact that this was a crazy shot, ignored the rifle rounds slamming into the car, and even ignored the ricochets pinging off the pavement. Jack's entire world narrowed to just two things. His sights, and the slow, steady pressure he was applying to the trigger. He resisted the urge to look at his target after the shot broke, heeding Chris's tutelage by concentrating solely on his sights. Only after the second shot did Jack check his work. The gunman was sprawled on the concrete 20 meters from the getaway car, but it might as well have been 2,000. No way was he going to be able to cover the distance. Jack had a prisoner. The two gunmen providing covering fire seemed to reach the same conclusion. As one, they swiveled toward their wounded comrade and fired into his prone form. The wounded man jerked under the vicious onslaught and then lay still. Without so much as a second glance, the remaining gunmen piled into their van and peeled away. Jack was back where he started, with nothing. Chapter 25. Good shooting. Dudu spoke reluctantly, as if the words had been dragged from his lips, but he still said them, which was an improvement. Unfortunately, the Shin Bet officer's praise did little to salve Jack's toxic mood. Maybe, Jack said from where he was crouched over the gunman, but he's still just as dead. Jack had pulled off the gunman's mask, but other than a Caucasian face, the man's features hadn't told him anything. Probably to be expected, but frustrating all the same. We're alive, Dudu said. That's something. Jack nodded. Yep. But Becca and Tommy are in trouble. Israel is a small country, Dudu said, squeezing Jack's shoulder. And there's a reason why terrorists fear the Shin Bet. The kidnappers won't get far. Don't take this the wrong way, Jack said. But from what I've seen so far, this crew is running roughshod over you and your Shin Bet. Dudu's face clouded at Jack's remark, but a frantic shout in Hebrew brought the Shin Bet officer up short. Turning from the dead assassin to the lead car, Dudu barked a question. The Seiret Matkal commando standing next to the car answered in another indecipherable stream of Hebrew. For once, Jack didn't need a translator. The look on Dudu's face was translation enough. Jack followed behind the Shin Bet officer's sprinting form, knowing what they'd find. Dudu stopped at the car, shouldering the commando out of the way. Crouching eye level with the driver's side window, he peered into the interior. Then he stood and pounded his fist against the car's roof, denting the metal. Jack slid past Dudu, steeled himself, and looked inside. He wished he hadn't. The driver was dead. And while this was shocking, if that had been the totality of the carnage, Jack could have borne it. But it wasn't. Tal was sprawled across the front seat, half of her face missing. Only hours ago, Jack had looked into those laughing brown eyes and wondered about what might have been if they'd met at a coffee shop instead of an interrogation room. Now, he'd never know. Her Jericho pistol lay on the seat next to her, just beyond her grasping fingers. Opening the car door, Jack stretched past the driver and grabbed her gun. Then he reverently pressed the polymer grip into Tal's hand. What are you doing? Dudu said. I have Irish blood, Jack said, turning to face the Israeli. Irish warriors die with their weapon in their hands. She deserves the same. Dudu looked back at Jack, his eyes blazing. For a moment, Jack thought the Shin Bet officer might deck him. Instead, the man slowly nodded. And what do the Irish do to their enemies? Hunt them down. Irish and Israelis have much in common, Dudu said. He stared at Jack in silence until the shrieking of approaching sirens prodded him to action. Go, Dudu said, quickly. Otherwise, you'll be detained and questioned. Where? Jack said. Dudu shrugged his massive shoulders. That is up to you. If you head to the airport, I'll make sure you board unmolested. But if you have something else in mind, take this. Dudu fished a phone from his pocket and offered it to Jack. The first stored number is mine, Dudu said. Stay off the grid, but when I call, be ready to hunt. Jack stared at the phone, considering his options. The smart play, the only play, was to head to the airport. This was not a campus-sanctioned operation, and Jack was certainly way past his original charter of running an asset validation exercise. Did he want to help Becca and Tommy? Of course. But he had no idea who Becca was, let alone why she was in trouble. Not to mention that even though he'd saved her life twice, Becca was clearly still in danger. Anyone could see that his choice was clear. Go to the airport and call it a day. Except in his mind's eye, Jack kept returning to two things. Tal's lifeless eyes and the terrified look on Becca's face. Sometimes a good man has to be willing to pay a price for doing what's right. With a sigh, Jack took the phone. There's a coffee shop 2 blocks away, Dudu said as the first ambulance careened around the corner. I'll pick you up when I'm ready. Better call instead, Jack said, dropping the phone in his pocket. I won't be there. Where are you going, Jack Ryan? Dudu said as Jack walked away. To get answers. Chapter 26. Jack worked through an abbreviated surveillance detection route, or SDR, trying to temper his impatience with the need to stay operationally sound. It certainly wasn't lost on him that since the cell phone riding in his right pocket had been provided by an officer of Israel's Internal Security Service, he might as well be wearing a strobing beacon strapped to his head. There was not an SDR in existence that could shake Israeli surveillance, as long as he was in possession of Dudu's phone. But it wasn't the Israelis Jack was worried about. Walking down a side street protected by leafy sycamore figs and populated by chic stores and even trendier coffee shops, Jack looked for evidence of surveillance in the glass storefronts. Since this morning, Jack had survived 3 different encounters with men who harbored murder in their hearts. That was a record, even for him. In the ensuing hours, Jack had been reacting, moving from one potentially deadly situation to another. As such, he'd yet to take the time to engage his most deadly weapon, his brain. Stopping at a sabik shop, Jack ducked inside and read the menu. The woman behind the counter said something to him in Hebrew, to which Jack shook his head with a smile. Then he walked outside, doubled back on the direction he'd been traveling while crossing the street to a gelato shop. Entering, he settled on a scoop of green ice cream that he hoped was a close cousin to pistachio, before crossing the pedestrian causeway in favor of a narrow alley cutting between the streets. Emerging into yet another pedestrian area, Jack ducked into a small drugstore lined with patrons. Shuffling to the end of the line, he browsed the soap section, which, conveniently, offered him a view of the street outside. Pedestrian traffic seemed normal. A father pushing a pair of twins in a stroller made way for a mother cycling past with her toddler strapped to a specially designed child seat behind her. Across the avenue, a man and a woman got up from a table and strolled over to where a scooter was parked. The man stepped onto the small rectangular platform, and the woman climbed aboard behind him, wrapping her arms around his waist. A moment later, he keyed the gas and they motored away. Jack saw no familiar faces, or perhaps more important, familiar shoes. As he'd learned from Mary Pat's tutelage, hair could be concealed with a hat, facial features could be broken up with glasses, and shirts could be covered with jackets. But shoes were a different matter. No one, spies included, wanted to walk around all day carrying a second pair of shoes, which, by and large, meant that surveillance teams tended to neglect that item in their wardrobes. Accordingly, Jack had become somewhat of an expert at memorizing shoes. He shifted his attention lower, mentally cataloging the feet he saw walking to and fro on the cobblestone streets. Nothing. This didn't necessarily mean that Jack was clean, but he was fairly certain that assassins weren't lying in wait. Now it was time to make a decision. Shuffling to his left to make way for another customer, Jack gave up on the soap in favor of the small rack of hardback books as he turned the problem over in his head. Nothing made sense. Jack wasn't psychic, but like most espionage professionals, he was pretty good at reading people. If he'd had time to question her, Jack was certain that he could have sussed out why Becca was being targeted. But with nothing more than her name to go on, Jack was no closer to understanding what was at play. Still, he did know one thing for sure. Becca wasn't an international woman of mystery. She might have come up on the wrong person's radar, but she was not an espionage professional. Tommy's presence alone was proof of that. So why had the same Asian man tried to assassinate her twice? And why had her pursuers now changed tack from murder to kidnapping? Jack picked up a book at random and leafed through the pages, an entry from Brad Taylor's Pike Logan series. Israelis had good literary taste. Espionage fiction aside, Something about the change in the assassin's tactics bothered Jack. He couldn't pin it down at first, and then realization came like a lightning bolt from a clear sky. "Holy shit!" Jack said, slamming the book closed with a resounding crack. Ignoring the startled looks from his fellow patrons, Jack placed the book back on the shelf next to the newest Mark Graney Greyman novel and hustled out the door. The Asian assassin had targeted Becca twice. Each time, were it not for Jack's intervention, she would have been killed. But during the kidnapping, they'd gone to great pains to take Becca alive. Why? Because Becca's kidnappers were not the same people who'd been trying to kill her. Jack thought this over as he cut through another series of alleys, heading west toward the beach, where he knew taxis would be much more plentiful. He tried to work through why two groups of armed men might be seeking Becca, but quickly gave up. Without understanding who Becca really was and what she represented, it was pointless to guess at her attackers' motives. He needed more information. Time to up the stakes. Emerging onto the boulevard, Jack merged with the flow of foot traffic, meandering parallel to the beach. For once, his attention wasn't captured by the breaking swells or girls sunning themselves in barely their swimsuits. Instead, Jack's attention was occupied by something considerably more mundane. Taxis. Tel Aviv's reputation as a mini Silicon Valley was aptly deserved. While a trend-setting company named Uber was making its American debut, an enterprising Israeli startup was unleashing an app called Gett. Essentially Uber for taxis, it revolutionized Israel's transportation system, providing easy access for natives and tourists alike. But now this technical innovation made it incredibly difficult for Jack to find a cab without using his phone. The first two taxis he approached drove off without a second glance. By the third, Jack had an epiphany. What better way to get the notice of people driven by innovative capitalism than by displaying a little innovation of his own? Reaching into his pocket, Jack withdrew a wad of American dollars. As the next cab accelerated away from the curb, Jack took his life into his hands by stepping into the vehicle's path. The driver brought the car to a screeching halt, but before he could say something that would irrevocably damage relations between two allied nations, Jack shoved a stack of 20s at him. $100 to give me a ride, Jack said, playing up the loud and dumb American stereotype for all it was worth. Use the app, the driver responded in flawless English. Lost my phone at the beach, Jack said, gesturing behind him. I need to get back to my apartment. $150, please. What's the address? The driver said. Jack relayed the street number he'd memorized before boarding the long flight from Dallas. 100's fine, the driver said. Get in. Thank you, Jack said, sliding into the back seat. He'd no sooner closed the door than the driver accelerated away from the curb, merging with the traffic with the fearlessness of a kamikaze pilot. Which was an interesting comparison. Because if Jack was wrong about where he was headed, death and destruction were certain to ensue. Chapter 27. This is it, the driver said, easing over to the curb. $100. Keep the change, Jack said, passing the man $150 instead. The number one rule of working clandestinely was to be unremarkable and therefore unremembered. Unfortunately, in his need to find an anonymous taxi, Jack had already become memorable. There was nothing he could do about that. But he could influence the way he was remembered. After all, a happy taxi driver with a fat tip in his pocket was a whole lot less inclined to talk with his co-workers about the jackass of an American who'd practically commandeered his car. Besides, it was the CIA's money, not his. And from what he knew about the world's premier intelligence agency, dollars were not something the Central Intelligence Agency had in short supply. Climbing out of the cab, Jack crossed the street and began walking south, until the taxi pulled from the curb and turned and drove away. Once the vehicle was out of sight, Jack doubled back, this time crossing to the opposite side of the street. His eyes swept the landscape as he walked, for once not looking for surveillance. Jack wasn't sure what he was searching for, but he was convinced he'd know it when he saw it. He was about to commit a major operational faux pas, and minimizing the ensuing damage was the least he could do. After almost reaching the end of the street, Jack began to worry that what he was searching for couldn't be found. Then he discovered them. A cluster of bushes growing about thigh high from a concrete-ringed planter. The branches sported bunches of bright pink flowers, and the plants brought some much-needed greenery to the otherwise bleak concrete and blacktop cityscape. But Jack didn't key off the bushes because of their aesthetic appeal. He peered into the cluster of green, parting the plant's thick leaves to verify that the innermost roots were obscured from view. Once he confirmed his suspicion, Jack looked up and down the sidewalk. The street was still mostly deserted, with the exception of two men seated and engaged in a heated conversation in a coffee shop across the way. Jack pulled the phone Dudu had given him from his pocket. After a final, much more covert look at his surroundings, courtesy of the coffee shop's floor-to-ceiling bay window, Jack dropped to one knee and began tying his shoe. Except that in between fiddling with his already fastened laces, Jack slid the phone deep into the bush's sappy embrace. Then he stood, brushed off his hands, and crossed the street a final time. Walking past an empty cafe with the chairs stacked on top of the outdoor tables, Jack followed a cobblestone footpath that rambled by several trees sprouting from bricked-in enclaves. The path wound alongside the cafe and then meandered into a cul-de-sac of sorts, on which sat a small grocery store, a falafel stand with its metal grating already drawn down for the day, and a door leading to an adjacent apartment building. Like most Tel Aviv residential areas, an obligatory bike stand sat in front of the building, half full of bikes of varying shapes and sizes. The bikes looked inexpensive and were chained to the stand. In Jack's experience, these were the two qualities necessary for longevity on a Tel Aviv street. Owners of high-end bikes either stored them in their flats or had them stolen, no matter how ingenious the locking mechanism. There was no middle ground. Stooping next to a rusted hunk that looked like it had last carried a passenger when the most famous of Jews had been carrying his cross to Golgotha, Jack felt beneath its worn seat until his probing fingers encountered something metal. A key. Jack tore the key away from where it was taped to the torn fabric with a satisfying rip and headed toward the communal door. In the years he'd been living a double life as a financial analyst and covert operative, Jack had learned one infallible truth. No operation ever went as planned. Often this meant that the most important part of the operational brief was the portion the team hoped never to use, the contingency plan. Though the asset validation exercise wasn't an operation in the truest sense of the term, Peter had still briefed a contingency plan. In this case, it was fairly simple, but it existed all the same. If shit went sideways, rendezvous at the safe house, and if you lost your key in the rough and tumble that sometimes accompanied even the most benign of operations, get the spare from beneath the bicycle seat. Once again, Jack was grateful that Peter and Ding had both earned their spurs in the same organization. Reaching the door, Jack pressed the key into the requisite slot, turned it, and felt the most wonderful of sensations, a lock disengaging. He leaned against the door and it swung open on well-oiled hinges. Catching the metal handle, Jack eased it closed and then ignored the elevator in favor of a winding staircase. The safe house was a couple floors up, but Jack didn't mind the exercise. Besides, once you'd been trapped in an elevator with someone who wanted to kill you, stairs weren't so inconvenient. Three flights of stairs later, Jack stood at the landing, peering down the hall. Unlike a stereotypical safe house, the apartment complex wasn't decrepit, nor was the air filled with stale cigarette smoke. The hallway's tile was clean and uncracked, and the overhead lighting was uninterrupted and bright. No long shadows hid men in trench coats and fedoras waiting to complete a brush pass. The safe house sat above the now-closed coffee shop, and the narrow hallway contained just two doors, one to Jack's immediate left that led to a storage room, and one at the far end of the hallway. While the atmosphere wasn't exactly cheery, neither did it have the foreboding, murky feel of the safe house's ding favored. And yet there was something that made Jack hesitate before strolling down the narrow hallway. An operational team was gathered behind the unassuming door 20 meters distant. And though this wasn't a slum in Beirut or a banlieue of Paris, Jack couldn't help feeling like he was entering the den of a wild animal. A cornered wild animal. Jack considered giving Peter a heads up that he was coming, but didn't. This was a crash meeting in every sense of the word. Somewhere, a team of killers had Becca and Tommy, and at any moment the phone Jack had hidden in the bushes could ring. The clock was ticking. Entering the hall, Jack walked to the far door and knocked twice. He heard a rustling. Then the door swung open, revealing two things. Peter, and the business end of a Glock 19. Chapter 28.
Jack, Peter said, surprise coloring his voice. Come in.
Peter holstered the pistol in the back of his pants and shuffled right to make room for Jack, favoring his left leg as he did so. Though he had to be at least 20 years older than Jack, the CIA operative was still built like the door kicker he'd once been. Muscular shoulders topped a broad chest and thick arms. Peter's receding hair was cropped close to the skull on top, but he still sported longish sideburns that were anathema to a classic military haircut. His eyes were a deep, startling blue, seemingly at odds with his brown, weathered face. If not for the awkward shuffle induced by his left leg, Peter would still look at home in a pair of multicams and a Cry precision plate carrier. But as Ding had explained, a Taliban sniper had put Peter's operational days firmly behind him. Why are you here? Peter said, shutting and locking the door behind them. Sorry, Jack said. I know this is against protocol, but I need help.
Sure, Peter said, waving Jack forward. Come in, come in.
The entranceway passed through a tiny kitchen before emptying into a common area with a table to the right and a pair of couches and a chair framing a sliding glass door directly ahead. A narrow hallway trailed off to the left toward what Jack assumed were bedrooms and a bathroom. The space had the cramped, lived-in feel of safe houses the world over. Paper plates and containers of takeout food were stacked on the table, and several bags lined the far wall, packed and ready for an emergency bug-out should the occasion arise. The air smelled musky, with a trace of cigarette smoke, but as far as Jack could see, Peter was alone. This was probably better, all things considered. Jack didn't know the former paramilitary officer well, which was to say that he didn't know him at all. Even so, it didn't take a shrink to deduce that the CIA operative was going to be less than happy with the turd Jack was about to drop in his operational punch bowl.
Have a seat, Peter said, gesturing to the chair flanking the sliding glass door. Want a beer?
No thanks, Jack said, trying to keep the regret out of his voice. The truth was he would love a beer, but he didn't mix alcohol in work, especially when that work potentially involved putting steel on target. Dudu's parting words hadn't been the least bit ambiguous. When the cell phone rang, Jack intended to be ready. Thinking of the cell phone nestled in the bushes reminded Jack that this meeting had a sense of urgency for more reasons than one. All of this would be for naught if Dudu called while Jack was up here jawjacking with Peter. Best to keep things moving. So rather than take the offered seat, Jack remained standing. Look, I'm sorry for coming here unannounced, but things are a bit crazy.
No shit, Peter said. One moment I'm running another uneventful asset validation exercise. The next you're going hand to hand with Jet Li. What the hell happened?
Jack shook his head. I don't honestly know. I was watching the meet go down when a child the next stall over dropped something. An action figure. I went to hand it back to his mom and this Asian dude came from nowhere with a knife.
I saw, Peter said, crossing his arms across his massive chest. You did all right, by the way. Looks like he nicked you once or twice, but that's still good, considering. I'll take a gunfight over a tussle with a good knife man any day. You're damn lucky you didn't eat that blade. Jack shrugged. Sometimes it's better to be lucky than good. Anyway, if that was the end of the story, I'd either be surfing Mojave Beach or sitting in a plane somewhere over the Atlantic by now. But it's not.
What do you mean? Peter said.
The Shin Bet rolled me up. They let me go pretty quickly once the woman, Becca, told them what had happened. But not before one of the agents read me the riot act about operating as an undeclared intelligence officer.